Welcome to the Vet Podcast by the vet gurus, Brendan and Mark. Get ready for the latest veterinary news, information and entertainment. Don't forget to visit us at the Vet Gurus website, vetgurus.com. Now, sit back, relax. It's over to the Vet Gurus, Brendan and Mark.
Welcome again, as always, episode 345 of the Vet Gurus. Brendan here with Mark, and I'm upbeat, Mark. I'm excited. Are you excited?
I am excited. I didn't realize it was always episode 345, though.
Yes, it is. It is 346, sorry, 346, not 345. You are actually right, there it is, 346. If that's what you're hinting at. No, it is. No, actually, no, looking back, it is 345. I'm going through the list here. Yes, 346 is next week. So it is 345. You've got me really confused here, Mark, at the start. But
let's come back to why you're upbeat. Why are you upbeat, Brendan?
Because it will continue. The podcast will continue.
Yes.
Because the exciting news is our three main sponsors, Mark. I've flicked out an email to them. We do that every year, Mark, and all three of them have replied with a resounding yes. They wish to continue helping our podcast and help it going, and it's fantastic because it helps pay for those production costs, Mark. So I'm excited.
Brendan, I think it is wonderful, and I treasure that connection and relationship with our sponsors, and not least because, I mean, we benefit financially. It covers some of the cost of production of this podcast. But moreover, it's a testament to, like, how good they think we are when we aren't really that good. So, yeah, I really love the fact that we're able to obtain that support from such important people in our section of the profession. But I'm now disconnected.
Well said, Mark. Well said. So a shout out to those three main sponsors, Mark. It obviously is well and truly due this week, and that's Specialized Animal Nutrition, Jennifer and the team, Oxbow Australia products, and all the wonderful accessories that you can buy for your rabbits and mammals, etc. Microchips Australia, Doug and the team, and big shout out to Doug. He's been a bit under the weather, been a bit unwell, Mark, and he's trying to bounce back, and he will bounce back, I'm sure, and I'm hoping that I'll catch up with him personally later on this month at the National Australian Veterinary Association Conference, which is here in Melbourne, Mark, so hopefully Doug will still be able to attend there, even though he's been a bit unwell. And least but not least, and finally, Chemical Essentials, Andrew, and the wonderful disinfective properties of the F10 range of products, Mark. F10 Australia distribution network, and gee, we splash it around like nobody's business in our clinic, I tell you what. So many, many thanks to our sponsors, Mark, and also our private sponsors, individual sponsors, Mark. We've got a couple of patrons at patreon.com, and we have the occasional person who throws us a bone, as we like to say, and just sends us a few dollars to help pay for those costs. And the final one is the people who go onto our Etsy site, etsy.com, etsy.com, and look for the Vet Gurus store and purchase some of the wonderful merchandise we have there. That's another way to help support us and to promote the podcast. So many thanks to you all. So, Mark, you need to quickly, before we jump into a couple of news stories we're going to rip through today, we've got a few things to do before the satellites get shot down. You're on the way back down south, aren't you? You've finally left your little abode up at the top of Australia, which you've been there for, what, almost 18 months and off continuously.
18 months. We've completed 454 kilometres of the 374 kilometre journey home, and we have a little mechanical issue with the brakes, but as we were talking about before we came on air, we've organised with the local mechanic to get that problem resolved this afternoon, and we'll be back on the road. And it's a beautiful spot here where we are, the Cowan Bend Free Camp. And we're right on the Cowan River, just about 3 kilometres north of the township of Cowan. and it's just a glorious spot, Brendan. It's freshwater creek. There's an abundance of freshwater life, and it's relatively free of saltwater crocodiles. So we've had a little swim, and
relatively free. That's good. Yeah,
and yeah, no, it's a wonderful part of the world. We feel very if you had to be stranded by mechanical disadvantage, this is just the place I recommend.
Good. And yeah, you've started the trek south back home, and then you're going to head off on another adventure at some stage soon. Well, actually a couple at least adventures, but we'll talk about them as they occur, I think, Mark. So yeah, safe travels the rest of the way home, and go easy on the brake pedal, Mark, I think is what you need to do. And I think with that, we'll jump into our two news stories. I don't think we can both chat about both of these stories, Mark. I think the first one was about, a bit of a worry, the massive failure of surveillance is the title for fire ants, and fire ant nests, more than 100 of them have been discovered on an army base west of Toowoomba in Queensland, Mark, and been struggling. I think it's a bit of an uphill battle, isn't it, to keep fire ants out of Australia now, because they've been detected in a few sites, Mark, and finding these more than 100 nests on the army base is certainly a worry. The article suggests that it could take several years, Mark, to fully eradicate them, if that. And they're throwing a bit of money at them. I'll tell you what, fair $592 million Australian dollars, the eradication program will cost over 4 years. And a Senate inquiry in Parliament, Mark, suggests that double that amount, $300 million Australian dollars, was needed to fund the eradication program properly, Mark. So they're pretty nasty, the old fire ants, aren't they, Mark? They're native to South America, and they were colonised southern United States, and they've made their way to Australia several times by international shipping. But so far we've been able to sort of keep the levels basically towards zero with the eradication program. But it's a worry when you get an outbreak with more than 100 nests, although I expect, being on an army base, Mark, they're probably going to nuke the site with insecticides, aren't they?
They're a really dangerous species, aren't they? They're
nasty. They're very aggressive to all the other insects and ants, yes, and things, aren't they?
Yeah. And they suspect that medically, that over 650,000 people a year would be stung, and of them, 175,000 would suffer allergic reactions, and some of those quite possibly could be fatal allergic reactions. So it's no small issue for humans either, but you're right, they're very aggressive in the environment, out-competing other ants and making it dangerous for many insects and small mammals and amphibians and reptiles to survive in the Australian environment.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, Mark, the Australia's peak body for allergy investigation, Mark, I like the name of it, the National Allergy Centre of Excellence. So I think you only get to get an appointment there if you've got an excellent allergy going on with you. But bit of a worry, Mark, the fire ants. What's the second news story, Mark? Have you got
our
that one
second
up?
Yes, I do. The deaths of 120 Amazon dolphins really, like, well, made me really sad. The Amazon River's pink dolphins are a threatened species, and among one of the there's only very, very few species that are freshwater, that live predominantly in freshwater. And the carcasses of 120 of them were found floating in a tributary of the Amazon River in Brazil. And the initial discussions were about a severe drought that's occurring there at the moment and the consequent heat in the water. It's just...
It's hot water, isn't it? Did you see that?
39 degrees.
That's, people like swimming in oceans where it's in the tropics or somewhere where the water's a bit warm, but 39 degrees is pretty damn hot, isn't it? Yes. It's not a good news story, is it?
I think it's going to be the sort of characteristic story we see over the, you know, the next few years, unless we are able. There's going to be little spots where the effects of climate change are devastating for particular species, and the series of deaths and problems with endangered species, I think that we're going to end up, well, I'm scared we're going to be numbed by it, Brendan. It's going to be such a roll call of disaster that we'll go, how do we amount the emotions to care about this when it's just happening relentlessly?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, you're correct there, Mark. It's it's not a good news story.
I think it's one of the important things that we continue to talk about it on our podcast, because we really care about it and we want to continually highlight, from a veterinary point of view, from a wild animal point of view, from a pair of people who are interested in conservation. We don't want to bring people down, but we do want to keep highlighting how important it is to keep climate change uppermost in our mind and affect change both in our own lives and locally and regionally and then across the whole planet.
Yep. And I plan to have a couple of really positive news stories next week, Mark. some definitely positive ones. I think with that, we're going to jump into our main topic here, Mark, and it's something we're just going to do a bit of an overview of shedding of the skin in reptiles, Mark, and scutes in the chelonians. And we have previously covered dissectisis, so abnormal shedding, in episode 233, which was back in March 2022, Mark. So I think we're well overdue to jump back into the shedding in reptiles, because it's such a common presentation, isn't it? Or even more common as a general question in a consultation with a reptile owner, where they quizzes on the aspects of the shedding process, Mark. So I thought it'd be a good one to just walk through the normal shed process as a general processes in the different types of reptiles, Mark, and what we normally see and what happens and what's expected to happen, and then we can chat a little bit about some of the abnormal shedding processes and go through some of the list of the many long things that can cause abnormal sheds, Mark.
Good topic, Brendan. Excellent topic.
So let's chat about what is a normal shed in a snake, Mark. So what I always like to sort of simplify things, me being a simple guy, Mark, and talk a normal shed in a snake, typically they shed the whole skin in one piece, don't they, Mark? And usually in lizards it's piecemeal, in that they shed in several little bits over that shed period of a few days up to a week or so. And in our chelonians, our tortoises and turtles, those scutes will usually, in a normal shedding situation, will shed just several bits of the mark. They don't have a massive number of scutes coming off at once, do they?
That's right. It is different between the different families within the order Reptilia, the turned out inside out sock pattern of the snakes versus our sort of sheet convenient sheets of shed in reptiles, and then the tags and of the skin, and then the scutes intermittently, different ones come off over a period of time with our turtles.
Yes, and I sometimes get clients coming in, Mark, so my snake's just shredded. And I say to them, well, he does look pretty fit, your snake. He has been working out. Well done. You're looking after him well, and he is exercising, getting environmental enrichment. So why do they shed, Mark? Why are these animals shedding? What's the reason for it? Why do they do it?
This is an excellent question, Brendan. And the two typical answers are that it facilitates growth, that the skin of reptiles is not well adapted to continual steady expansion to allow growth. And so the reptiles, during the period of time that they're growing new skin, have a little spurt of growth and get a little bit bigger. I have I don't know how much that works, but certainly it seems to be a commonly reported reason. And the second one, of course, is that all of us mammals and birds have shed our skin. It's just that in reptiles it's become an episodic stepwise thing, presumably to facilitate growth rather than the continual cell by cell epidermal shedding that occurs in other species.
Yes, well said. I would agree 100%. It's part of that whole, you know, regeneration of skin and epidermis being exposed to the outside there, Mark, that it's going to get abraded and damaged, and then I think it's part of it is that continual replacement there. But it forms, as you so eloquently put it, in an episodic nature in our reptiles, Mark. And typically what happens with our snakes especially, Mark, and to a certain extent in the other reptiles as well, that normal shed process, what happens is they excrete almost like a lymph in between the old shed and the new shed, Mark, to help facilitate the removal in that normal shed process. And it's an important point when we're talking about some of the causes with the husbandry-related causes and environmental causes, Mark, that might be stopping that normal shed, Mark, if something's wrong with that husbandry and humidity and temperature as well.
It is a really fascinating process, isn't it? The way that the more aged surface layer of the skin cleaves away from the fresher, newer layer beneath, and like, as you said, a lymph-like fluid builds up to occupy that space. And it's interesting, I often talk to clients about how that process is mediated metabolically, that particularly the thyroid gland plays a particularly critical role in secreting the hormones that organize each stage of the death of the outer layer, the cleavage, the secretion of lymph. So I think it's always important to mention that it's, while we tend to focus, because we're veterinarians, because we focus on the functional aspects, we tend to focus on what we can see, but the whole process is mediated in the context of the reptile's whole metabolism. And so there are consequences, you know, an infection going on can have an effect on that thyroid metabolism and thereby interfere with the normal process and sequence of shedding.
Yep. Well, let's jump into, as we've just hinted, when things go wrong, Mark. Well, no, let's not. sticking with the normal shed process, one of those common questions that I get from new owners of reptiles is, you know, what is the process of the shed, which we just went through, and how do I help facilitate that? What things do I need to do or not do, Mark, when my snake is, as they say, coming into a shed?
You have excellent clients who ask excellent questions, Brendan.
Well, some of them.
So what do you tell them? What's the answer?
Yes. So we chat to them about the process, how long it takes. And again, it depends on from the moment they might notice a slight dulling of the skin of the snake to the actual shed, hopefully all in one piece, Mark, and that might take up to, you know, 1 to 2 weeks or so. So one of the important things you need to mention to the those new owners is the fact that animal is probably not going to take its routine feed during that period, because they probably feel a bit vulnerable when they're going through that shed process as they're putting energy into getting rid of that old shed and producing their new skin there, Mark. So often, don't panic. In fact, you know, it's due for a feed. Don't worry. Don't feed it.
Just wait. It's interesting. A lot of old herpetoculturists talk about the change in vision that occurs as that lymph builds up over that couple of weeks in the subspectacular space, because the scale over the snake's eye provides an additional part of the epidermis. And so, yeah, not only will they be badly out of sorts because of the changed metabolism, but they might not even see the world properly. Do you think that's a common associated
development? I mean, not that they see great anyway. Do they, the old snakes, but yes, absolutely. And typically what, you know, the usual thumbnail is that clouding over the eyes, we see that milky sort of coloration there over the eyes, the spectacles there, and then that clears, Mark, and when it clears a few days later, they, if everything goes to plan, they will do the full shed. So we need to be cognizant of not feeding them during that time, not panicking the fact that, you know, the owner might be panicking that they keep really detailed charts and that just skip to feed. Well, it's coming into a shed. Making sure that we have appropriate environment for the shed, Mark.
This sort of
touches on when we're talking about the abnormal. So we're crossing over the causes here and the prevention, I suppose. And that's humidity and temperature. So as we always bang on about, Mark, they're having an adequate temperature gradient relevant for that particular species of reptile. Having a substrate, Mark, that's suitable, that's not grotty, that's not that's clean regularly, that isn't full of bacteria that might cause an issue when, because when they shed, especially the snakes, Mark, they're skin's very permeable, isn't it, or we think. So that's when they're going to be prone to get in, you know, dermatitis or dermatitis. What would you call it?
Skin infection.
Skin infections. Yes. And making sure the humidity is just right, not too wet, not too dry. So if the humidity is too dry, Mark, classically, what could potentially happen is that fluid that's excreted between the old and the new shed dries out.
Yes.
So they cannot shed in one piece for the snakes or the even the lizards or the land tortoises. Chelonians say they may not be able to shed their scutes or their piecemeal shed, Mark. And if it's too wet, then potentially the opposite. If it's way too humid, they are going to be at a much greater risk of getting a skin infection, as you mentioned.
Yes, and I think the other thing, the practical consequence of that advice about humidity is to consider some form of maybe even humidity box, where I frequently talk about a place in the enclosure, maybe a plastic shoebox that's filled with an absorbent material, maybe sphagnum moss or peat moss, something that can be sterilized because, as you said, the skin is vulnerable during that time of increased permeability and new exposure of the new underlying skin. But those environments, and it's interesting when you provide those are environments that the snakes will seek out. It's almost like they know they need to provide that humid environment for their skin. And they'll even use a little bit of a gradient effect. If the humidity is fine on the surface, they'll sit on the surface. If they need more humidity, they'll burrow down into the substrate to facilitate a greater concentration of water outside. So humidity boxes.
Yes, and with some of them, and not all of them, but some of these reptiles, you also need something for them to help remove that shed, Mark.
Yes.
So having some sort of abrasive surface, it might be a simple branch, it might be a rock, etc. So if that enclosure is completely sort of sterile and just smooth surfaces, then it may struggle to remove that shed, Mark.
They do need to catch, particularly snakes like to catch their lip on something that's abrasive, or will just catch the beginning of the shed and help them to manoeuvre it off their lip and face and hold it while they crawl out of it. So, often branches. I try to avoid things that are more broadly abrasive, because you don't necessarily want them having extensive scratches, but something that has a reasonable edge that they can catch it on. Often the end of some enclosure furniture like a branch works really well, but being aware that if they don't have that, they won't be able to start the process and then can get into trouble.
Yes. And speaking of trouble, Mark, if something does go wrong with this process, we should talk about not only the potential causes, including the ones we just mentioned, incorrect sort of husbandry or temperature enclosure furniture, and how to treat or resolve that dysectisis, the abnormal shed, Mark. And my first comment to the clients or even vets and vet techs, vet nurses is go slow. Don't panic.
Yes.
With the majority of these, you don't need to try and rip off the whole shed and cause further damage to the animal. We can take our time with some of these techniques of the, you know, helping remove that shed or an assisted shed with them, can't we?
Yeah, definitely. That's of course the everyone wants their animal to look perfect, and after the sheds they do look refreshed. Yes. And renewed, and while they're piecemeal shedding bits here and there, and they can look really untidy and even maybe a little bit ill, but you're exactly right. The best thing to do is take it nice and slow. Think about the steps that are going to be most effective for the individual you're dealing with, and not expect that it's going to happen all in one treatment or one day. It's very often several days to turn these around safely and ensure that they're back to normal.
Yes. So, well, let's stick with the treatment of it, Mark. So what do we do? What do we do to help get that shed off? What are some of the simple techniques we can recommend to the clients, Mark? And what are some of the more invasive things that we might have to do in the clinic if things aren't going well?
Well, it's fairly intuitive, Brendan. I like the idea of if an animal is having trouble with a shed, then to set them up with us in an environment that has increased humidity. And the technique that I've found with my own snakes that works really well is to have a towel, a small towel, make sure that it's warm and wet, and to cover the snake over with that, making sure that if you've got a warm, wet towel, that the snake still can breathe, making sure that its head's not squeezed between two layers. But most snakes will sit there just with the head poking out for an extended period of time, 5 or 10 minutes, and then gently getting them, stimulating them to crawl through the towel, reapplying it over and over again. That will often, just that increase in humidity will often be enough to soften the skin that has stuck there, and then that gentle abrasion of the towel allows that skin to be wiped away. Generally, I find I can't remove it all in one sitting, and I don't try because I don't want to stress the animal, but it one or two, maybe three sittings, and you can usually remove all that skin in most uncomplicated dysectisis cases.
Absolutely. Go slow. And it can be that simple, and gently then having, you know, I recommend a similar process, Mark. Sometimes depending on the snake, it might be a very shallow bath as well as warm water bath with the towel, and then gently rubbing that towel across the snake. So we're sort of hydrating the skin or that shed that's stuck on there, and we're just trying to soften it up, as you say, and we don't have to do it all at once, so take your time. And I really stress to the client, you know, do it, you know, 5 minutes or so once it's soaked, using the towel, and then try again tomorrow, and then the next day, and then the next day. And if you're still having troubles and you haven't removed it all by a week from now, come back and see us, Mark. So it's amazing how many of them just bit by bit and going slow, and you get there, and nothing more fancy than a bit of water, Mark.
Yeah. So, at a cost that most of my clients would be happy with.
Yes. I don't have to. I have to go and use buy a towel, do I? An extra towel. Yes. So it can be that simple. But if we do have regions, Mark, where the shed is obviously stuck down and after multiple attempts of trying to remove it. What's our sort of next step, or what do you attempt to do, Mark?
Well, generally, once it gets to that stage, it's a bit of a two-pronged approach. The first one is to deal with the shed specifically, and that might involve even a short anaesthetic or at least a sedation. And then similar humidification, moistening, and then sometimes with magnification, we're using fine instruments to catch the edge of that that skin and get it off where we can't just wipe it off. We often have to think about an antiseptic on the skin because once we get to that stage, there obviously is complication enough that the skin is vulnerable. And even in cases, we'd need to think about systemic antibiotics as a preventative. And in many of these cases, there may be infection. And so taking a, imprint, an impression of the damaged skin that you've been able to remove, identifying if there are gram-negative or gram-positive bugs in that skin, and then maybe even considering culture and sensitivity to affect antibiosis so that that doesn't complicate the healing process. Have I been talking to myself? Have I disconnected? Brendan, are you there? Calling Brendan?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here.
Excellent.
Yes, I am here. Yes, so it's not rocket science, is it, Mark? It's just a logical approach to removing the shed and to help in that shed that's stuck on there, Mark. And if we look like we've got an infectious process going on there, ideally doing a bit of a culture there because we might have something weird and wonderful there that we need to target specifically, mightn't we, Mark? And do you then put them on what sort of substrate do you put them on, those troublesome ones, Mark, where we had some obvious skin irritation or damage there as well?
Paper towels. Yep. Yeah, we just use something that's soft, non-abrasive, easily replaced, inexpensive, and
Kiss. Keep it simple, stupid. Yes.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yes. So, yes. And then once we've resolved that retained shed, whether it was a simple one or a complex one with further treatments, Mark, then we jump into looking at those causes, Mark, and preventative aspects. And we've already touched on a couple of these. And not unsurprisingly, husbandry, Mark, is often the underlying issue there, Mark. And we've mentioned the humidity and the temperatures there, Mark. What else do we need to sort of consider with potential causes for an abnormal shed?
Well, definitely having a look at the hardware that manages the particularly the temperature and day length, that low grade irritation that comes around from burns from lights and heaters. So they may not be furiously third degree burns. They may just be the equivalent of a bad sunburn, and that may lead to a problem. So specifically looking at that, the light and heating arrangements in the enclosure is one of the first things I try to make sure I'm looking at.
Yep. Yes. You did touch on one of the other potential causes, didn't you? And especially for if we have a snake that has a once-off dissectitis, then we start thinking of these, they haven't been cleaning their enclosure, they've got incorrect furniture, their humidity, temperature's not quite right. But if it's a reptile that has ongoing issues with shedding, Mark, then we start to look at these underlying conditions. And you touched on one potential cause, endocrine problems, didn't you?
Definitely.
Yes.
And I think the key thing I'd say about that is that there have been a number of cases we look at blood work, particularly to look at the likelihood of an occult infection. That seems to be a very common consequence of these repeated dissectitis patients. But we are always on the lookout for other metabolic diseases, particularly endocrine diseases, and particularly anything that might affect the thyroid. And I do feel that we've had a couple of snakes, obviously difficult to quantify with with, you know, the testing of thyroid in these species is not, it's not validated. But we've had some numbers that make us think this is quite likely to be a metabolic problem, a hypothyroid case that has triggered the repeated shedding issues. So, and you need to look at the prey items in those cases that might be contributing to more general endocrine problems, whether they be reproductive or otherwise,
yep,
even down specifically to something like thyroid disease.
Yes. So I think it's a very important point. If they're having ongoing issues with dyssexosis, to start thinking what else is wrong with this animal. Is this just an indicator of some other underlying condition, or does it have other comorbidities sitting there in the background there, mate?
So the last thing I was going to mention about this too, Brendan, is that there are a number of breeds of what do they call them now, morphs, the altered skin structure morphs, particularly amongst the bearded dragons, and they definitely have an increased propensity to shedding problems. And I actually would go so far as to, I know I'm getting on a bit on my soapbox here, but I go so far as to say that renders them non-desirable animals to breed, because they have a, you know, a fundamental fault in their genetics that more than predisposes them, makes it likely they'll develop these problems. So those reduced scalation bearded dragons, I think you can, if you have one of those, you can expect there to be dyssexosis problems. And if you don't have one, don't get one.
Don't get me started, Mark, on some of these breeds or some of these variations that just should not exist, Mark. They shouldn't be there. Go back to nature, I think. Go back to nature and just go for the basics with them instead of trying to breed all these fancy colorations and morphs and breed in trouble. Breed in trouble.
Yes. The natural ones are so beautiful, Brendan.
Yes, yes, they are. Well, we covered a fair bit there, Mark. We ripped through it, but we still ended up being 40 minutes or so. But I wanted to do a bit of an overview. I think we got there in the end as far as the potential causes and treatment options, and also a little bit about the normal shed process in reptiles, Mark. And we didn't talk too much about the chelonians, but the same sort of story. I think the main one that I see with abnormal scutes, so a lot of the scutes coming away with an aquatic turtle, Mark, is a sudden change in the water where they've had a sudden change in the pH, Mark.
Yeah,
so it's become markedly acidic or alkaline. So it sets them off into a sort of shedding frenzy, Mark.
Exactly. And there's some things that we can talk about in another podcast about how sheds might be affected by disease and how, you know, skin wounds and things that happen with sheds, how the pattern of recovery occurs. But we've bored people for long enough, Brendan.
I think Mr. Outro needs to get here and we need to get out of here, and we will talk to you all next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Vet Podcast by the Vet Gurus. Don't forget to visit us at the website vetgurus.com, where you can subscribe, view show notes, listen to previous episodes and more. You can contact us via email at vetgurus@gmail.com to ask a question or just say hi. Thanks again, and see you next time.